How will we power our future? Can we create a healthy and clean economy? Climate One at the Commonwealth Club is at the forefront of the global debate about energy, economy, and the environment. Bringing together the brightest and most provocative leaders of our time, Climate One is the place where big ideas get heard. With thoughtful and insightful discussions on policy, business, science, and culture, Climate One founder Greg Dalton gets to the heart of the matter. It's our future. It's time to come together.
Welcome to Climate One at the Commonwealth Club. I'm Greg Dalton. The oil disaster in the Gulf of Mexico demonstrates how reliant we are on our oceans for food, energy, and jobs. Today, we take a look at the state of the oceans around America and discuss how to reconcile competing claims on marine resources. Last summer, President Obama announced a new national oceans policy. What will it accomplish? How can we balance the needs of today with the rights of future generations? Should we drill for oil at sea or on shore? Here to discuss these questions and more with our audience in San Francisco are two senior officials from the Obama administration. Nancy Sutley is chair of the Council on Environmental Quality at the White House, and Jane Lubchenco is administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Please welcome them to Climate One.
Close enough. Close enough.
Thank you both for coming. Welcome to Climate One.
Thank you.
Nancy Sutley, let's begin with you. The National Oceans Policy, you know, what is it and what is its significance?
Well, we started this effort. The president asked us to lead a task force of really an alphabet soup of federal agencies because so many agencies have a piece of the oceans. And he asked us to look at really three things. One is, what would a National Oceans Policy look like that was focused on our stewardship of our marine and coastal resources? How should the federal government organize itself? And I know that sounds very bureaucratic, but when you have that many agencies with a little piece of the ocean, it turns out to be a very important question. And the third thing he asked us to do was to look at something which I'll only use the term once, coastal and marine spatial planning, which is thinking about a way to organize activities, the things that we value in the ocean, in the oceans, and how we sort of organize those uses. And so we took about a year of intensive effort, of a lot of meetings, a lot of public meetings. We did one here in San Francisco last September, a lot of expert roundtables to talk about these three questions. And what emerged from that is a long report, but an executive order from the president establishing this National Oceans Policy, establishing a National Oceans Council, which I co-chair along with Dr. John Holdren, the president's science advisor and director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, and a framework for organizing our uses of the ocean. And I think at the core of that oceans policy, and I will steal Jane's very good line, which is, for the first time, the United States has articulated a policy that says that healthy oceans matter. That's really at the heart of the policy, in that we have to think about our stewardship responsibilities for today, for the uses today, for restoration, preservation of healthy oceans and coastlines, and that the federal government has a responsibility to the public to organize itself into this National Ocean Council to carry out this policy and to coordinate and be more coordinated in the way that we approach the oceans. And, you know, I think the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico sort of shows that we have a lot of competing uses of the ocean, whether it's just the habitat value, seafood production, energy production. And we have to be a lot smarter and use the information that we have about these uses and the appropriate uses and where it's not appropriate to do anything in the ocean, and organize ourselves better. So that's the work that the National Ocean Council is going to take on. But we also recognize that, you know, each region of the country, each coastline is different, so that all of this work is going to be done at the regional level. So The West Coast, the governors of Washington, Oregon, and California have already organized themselves on the oceans. So to take the work that's been done in California and along the West Coast, in Rhode Island and along the New England coast, and try to bring federal, state government, local government, communities together to make smarter decisions about our ocean resources. So that's, in a nutshell, what we're trying to do.
Dubchenko, how is this going to affect the lives of commercial people who make their living from the ocean or people who enjoy the ocean? Bring it down to sort of what it's going to mean to American citizens, this new National Oceans Policy and Council.
Greg, I think a good place to start is what's happened in the Gulf. And I think it really does, as Nancy says, illustrate how people's lives and livelihoods and our economy is dependent on healthy oceans. And when we have a disaster like the one that happened in the Gulf, it really underscores in very sad but graphic ways how many people in that region really depend on a healthy Gulf for their jobs. And the reality is that so many things that we do on land or in the oceans have inadvertently contributed to degradation of the oceans over decades and decades and decades. And this new National Ocean Policy is quite remarkable because it really does say that healthy oceans matter and that we have a collective responsibility to get our act together and to do more than an issue-by-issue, sector-by-sector approach, a more holistic understanding of how we can use oceans without using them up, how we can work together to make decisions with the people who are affected in an area about what combination of activities can coexist in an area that will minimize conflicts and minimize adverse environmental impacts, and do so in a way that can streamline regulations, can streamline the kinds of hoops that we have to go through, but focusing on the bottom line of ending up with healthy oceans. So this is a new process. It teed off the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy and the Pew Oceans Commission. We learned huge lessons from what states and regions have done, and California had lots and lots of really good things in process that we could tee off from and listen to and learn from. But we're really in the early stages of this.
So just hypothetically, if this had existed 3 years ago, would it have prevented what happened in the Gulf? How would it be different if this had existed, or what will it do to prevent future crises like that?
Mm-hmm. I think it's difficult to play the what-if game because we have hindsight now. But I think it's fair to say that the process we envision will enable all the relevant agencies to work with the regions and craft a vision for a large marine ecosystem, whether it's the Gulf or the California current large marine ecosystem or New England or whatever, and have a better process for working together to define the combination of activities that can enable a healthy ocean and can minimize, I mean, the oceans are becoming increasingly crowded places, and there are more and more conflicts. And so this is an opportunity to work with the full range of users and do some, I learned lots of new terms with the Gulf disaster. One was deconflict, and we need to deconflict oceans, among other things.
So a lot of different organizations need to talk to each other, and you're the key referee when they don't disagree. And if I understand this correctly, this new executive order requires people to talk to each other, but still they have their own organizational mandates, and no one can tell another agency what to do that they couldn't do before. So it could be, how's the outcome going to be different?
Well, I think I'd say a couple of things. One is, and I think it gets back to the question about the Gulf, is I think we're really doing two things. We're getting everybody to the table, And it may come as a surprise to some people, but probably not, that not everybody in the federal government talks to each other. And even people who work on similar things don't necessarily talk to each other. So getting everybody around the table, and not just the federal government, state and local government, communities will be a part of this planning process. I think the other thing that it'll do is it'll bring all the information we have in one place and bring all that information together. So NOAA as an agency, a science agency, has an enormous repository of information, observational data about the oceans. Other agencies do too. And I think one of the things as we were putting this together that was so remarkable from my perspective is that, you know, we had sort of the usual suspects, NOAA, EPA, the Department of the Interior, who have these stewardship responsibilities over our natural resources. But we also had the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard not just kind of dragged along to participate, but seeing real value for their mission of protecting, you know, people on the seas. The same with the Navy and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the National Security Council, people whose primary responsibility isn't resource management or resource stewardship, seeing the value of being around the table with the resource agencies and with the agencies who have access to that kind of data and information and expertise that can help them do their job in deconflicting and, as Jane said, and reaching their mission. So it was a really remarkable process in that way, and I think it shows in the outcome of really strong support across the federal government and by the president for this policy.
Nancy Sutley is chair of the Council on Environmental Quality at the White House. She's here at Climate One with Jane Lubchenco, who is the administrator of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. And I'm going to start saying NOAA because I'm just not going to get all that
NOAA's
out.
Good.
Yeah, NOAA's good. Let's take a specific example. There's a new agency, formerly MMS, that's now called the Bureau of Oceans Energy Management and Regulation and Enforcement. People call it Bummer. I know you don't like that.
We were told to call it BOEM.
BOEM, okay. So Bummer.
All right. Well, so if they're listening, I tried.
How is the operation of that entity going to be different now that there's a National Oceans Council? It still resides in the Department of Interior. Mm-hmm. How will that be different now that other interests are required to be incorporated into how we use our oceans?
Well, you know, they have their requirements that are laid out in the laws that govern them about how they make decisions. But I think what we have is a whole new dimension of collaboration with the entire federal family and these regional planning organizations with state, local government communities. And then access to a whole lot more information and data than they keep within themselves. And I think, as Jane said, we're sort of at the beginning of a process, and we're going to learn a lot together about how we do this. But what we have is a statement on behalf of the federal government by the president that this is the national ocean policy to put in the forefront our stewardship of our ocean and marine resources and preserving, protecting, and restoring them. And so I think we're going to learn a lot in the next few years as a National Ocean Council and each agency that participates in that. And so we expect the Department of the Interior and BOEM to be, as they have been to date, an enthusiastic participant in that and seeing the value of that collaboration and that access to information that they don't have right at their fingertips right now.
President Bush created a large marine preserve near Hawaii. I believe it was 140,000.
I think Jane can actually pronounce it.
Papahana Mokuakea.
There we go.
Ah. Wow. There we go. That's pretty good, huh? 100 times the size of Yosemite. Is it working? Is that a success? Should we do more of those, put certain parts of the ocean just off limits where little or no human activity happens? Dr. Lubchenco?
The Scientific evidence that's coming from areas that are like Papahānaumokuākea, that are no-take marine reserves, is that they bring tremendous benefit both to the habitats, to the species within them, and that much of that benefit spills out to adjacent areas. It protects vulnerable habitats. It can protect species so that the individuals can get very large, and large individuals have much greater reproductive potential to make more young. And there is very powerful evidence coming from not only that area, but others like it around the world, that those no-take marine reserves can bring very significant value. One of the issues that will face everyone thinking about marine spatial planning of one sort or another is what combination of those protected areas, ideally in a network so they can be linked by the movement of juveniles and adults, a not unfamiliar process to people who have been in California with the Marine Life Protection Act process, which is also thinking about networks of protected areas. But to consider, instead of the approach that people have today, which is a sectoral approach, just fisheries, one agency regulates fisheries, somebody else regulates water quality, somebody else pays attention to conservation, somebody else pays attention to shipping, somebody else pays attention to drilling for gas or oil. And this piecemeal, sector-by-sector process, including conservation in that, is part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And what this new National Ocean Policy and the National Ocean Council, the regional planning bodies, is setting up is a mechanism for thinking more holistically about how those pieces fit together and how we can incorporate good conservation as part of a larger strategy. So we know that those areas are very important, bring good benefit. We know that in some cases, having a really, really large one like that one or the other very large ones that are in the Pacific, the Republic of Kiribati has another very, very large area. There's a role for those large ones. There's also a role for networks of smaller ones, but that needs to be cast in a larger context of the combination of activities that should appropriately be in those places. So it's okay to use oceans, we just don't want to use them up. And so you need a combination, a balanced approach. And we're sort of out of balance now, which is why this healthy oceans matter, this stewardship responsibility is so important.
Are there particular places, do you have a wish list, are there top one or two places that you would like to set off as, you said, no-take zones or marine preserves?
There are two reasons to consider no-take areas. One is to protect special places that have some unique character on land that would be Yosemite, for example, or Yellowstone. Another important criterion is to protect enough of critical habitats that you have enough to protect the ecological processes that are important for that entire area. And in that second consideration, it's not that there are particular places, you just need enough of each habitat type, for example, to protect. And so there's sort of two different concepts that need to be considered if you're thinking about setting aside areas in the ocean. And they both are important, but they serve different purposes.
Let's talk about food for a minute. A lot of the strain on the oceans is from our appetite for fish, which we think is good for us, but that causes all sorts of problems. There's a new book out called Four Fish by Paul Greenberg that chronicles a couple of fish, and he raises the question of GMO, genetically modified fish, being a good thing because it would reduce strain And he's talking about in contained areas where they can't escape, and it relieves the pressure on the fresh fish stocks, doesn't have the problems of fish farming. What do you think about that as environmentalists? Nancy Sutley?
I'm going to give the hard questions to Jane. But I do that. I mean, look, I think it gets back to the we have to do a couple of things. I mean, one is we have to go where the science tells us, and as you hear, Jane is an eminent marine ecologist and understands these interactions very well, and runs an agency full of scientists who understand these interactions very well. And so, as we think about whether it's aquaculture or something else, some other use of the ocean, we need to bring that science to bear, and we need to go where the science tells us to go. But we also have to recognize that there are increasing demands on the oceans. There are increasing demands on our marine resources. There's increasing pressure from pollution and development and climate change. We increasingly recognize the connection that what we do on land matters to the ocean. And so, you know, as we look at what we're trying to do is not to look at sector by sector, activity by activity, statute by statute, agency by agency, but look across these areas, starting at the regional level, to try to understand whether aquaculture belongs, does it belong anywhere, and if so, where and how, and what information, what do we need to understand about the impact on these on our ocean resources, things like that.
Pachinko, what do you think about? Could we entertain that idea?
As the agency that's responsible for managing marine fisheries and marine aquaculture, these areas are right in NOAA's bailiwick. And I think the real key focus needs to be on identifying and then implementing sustainable practices and policies. And we are in the process of trying to end overfishing and to recover various species as well as ecosystems that have been significantly depleted. That's not an easy thing to do, but it is one that we're beginning to make some headway with, and changing some of the incentives so that there is more incentive to think long term, to be good stewards. On the aquaculture front, there are some very significant challenges. Aquaculture is neither good nor bad. It is very important to the future of the planet, but it needs to be done in a way that's sustainable. And that's an easy thing to say. It's a harder thing to do. We are in the process at NOAA at working on a sustainable aquaculture policy, and we've been having lots of listening sessions on this and are guided by a lot of good thinking that has already gone on about this. Farming things that are lower trophic species, that the herbivores essentially, is a lot more benign. Tilapia, catfish, for example, than the carnivores, salmon, for example, or the way many shrimp are farmed is by feeding them fish meal. So aquaculture practices are quite variable from one species, or what is sustainable is partly a function of what you feed them, as well as the conditions under which you're growing them, whether they're native or not. And so it's actually a very rich discussion. California actually is a leader in many regards, but California's legislation on aquaculture is actually a very nice model, and we have looked at that very carefully, and it has a lot of really good elements that are important to define what does sustainable aquaculture look like.
That doesn't sound sustainable.
Whatever that noise is.
Hopefully not. Apologize for that. So as far as genetically modified organisms, is that something, if the science leads, that should say is it safe, you're willing to consider that? Or a lot of Americans think that that shouldn't open that can of worms because it only leads to bad things. That view, I think, prevails in Europe. So should GMO be even on the table, should be considered?
GMO is a very challenging issue for many societies. I think the jury is still out on a lot of the scientific issues. For GMO fish, there's a lot that we don't know, in part because a lot of the information is proprietary. And so it's very difficult to evaluate what the companies that have developed these things say about it because there's no independent verification. So I think there are a lot of questions that need to be asked about that.
How about bluefin tuna? I was in a restaurant recently in San Francisco, and the sushi chef was bragging about the fact that eat it while you can because it's going soon. And I was appalled and refused to order. And I mean, but that mentality is out there. Are we going to be able to save bluefin tuna? Is it, this policy going to have any impact? Obviously, this is an international issue, and there's been a lot of concern. Is bluefin tuna going to go away? Can we do anything?
Well, the U.S. government made a real attempt at the annual or biannual meeting of the, of course I'm going to forget what it means, but the CITES organization, the organization that regulates the trade in endangered species, and we tried to get the bluefin tuna listed because, and Jane will correct me if I'm wrong, I mean, there are very few of them left, and they are, I think, rapidly approaching the point where it may be impossible to save them as a species. They're very highly prized, so we tried very hard to get them listed and ran into a lot of resistance. So we're evaluating what options we have. I think it's an international issue that the world has got to agree on a strategy to deal with the overfishing that is causing this species to be on the brink of extinction.
But by the time everyone agrees, it's too late.
Well, we hope not. Okay. And we have other mechanisms that we're pursuing through regional fisheries management organizations. And we're looking at what our options are to see what we can do. But the U.S. government believes that we need to do something and do something soon.
Is yellowfin a little different, less dangerous, less perilous? I mean, there are even eco lodges here in San Francisco that have yellowfin on the tuna, yellowfin on the menu, which surprises me. But is that...
You know, it's hard to keep track of all the different species, and a lot of people are confronted with going to a restaurant and sort of not knowing. They have heightened awareness that there are some issues. They don't know what they are. There are a number of organizations, for example, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, that has a seafood watch card.
It's fantastic.
It's fantastic.
There's an iPhone app now.
There's an iPhone app for it. I was just going to mention that. And that's very cool. So it actually is an easy way to stay current with what is sustainably farmed or caught in a way that can help inform consumers, provide information to consumers so that you can make up your own mind.
Let's talk about coral. There's been a lot of concern about coral disappearing. Dr. Lubchenco, what is the prognosis for the coral systems in our lifetime?
At a global scale, corals are in very serious trouble, and they are threatened by a whole suite of different types of threats, one of which is now climate change, and with ocean waters warming, that stresses corals. And there have been many, many bleaching events over the last couple of decades that are very highly correlated with warmer waters.
What's a bleaching event?
Corals are animals, and they contain microscopic plants inside their bodies. Those microscopic plants are called zooxanthellae, and those plants capture sunlight and convert it into food, essentially, that they can pass on to the coral. So it's a symbiotic relationship. In turn, the coral provides a nice little home and protects the alga from being eaten by herbivores that might be out in the ocean. And when a coral is stressed, it often expels these microscopic plants, the zooxanthellae. And those zooxanthellae give the coral their color. And when those zooxanthellae are lost, the coral looks white because there's no pigment in the coral itself. And many corals cannot recover from that. Some can recover. Some can reacquire the zooxanthellae. So different corals are different. Corals can bleach if they're stressed by a number of different things. So warmer water can stress them. If there are upstream poor management practices, clear-cut logging, for example, that dumps a whole bunch of sediment in streams and that comes down into coral reefs, especially if mangroves have been eliminated from an area, that sediment can smother corals. So there are a number of things that are threats to corals that cause bleaching. There's also very serious overfishing, and in many parts of the world until relatively recently, and still in some places, people use dynamite to catch the few small fish that are remaining in an area that's already been significantly overfished. So overfishing, climate change, poor land use practices are all contributing to degradation of corals.
And what does that mean for the ocean system? Coral goes away. So
corals are really important habitat for, you know, they are the rainforests of the sea. They provide the three-dimensional structure for sponges and tunicates and fishes and sea urchins and sea stars and all the other amazing sea life. They live in that structure that's provided by the coral reef. And you lose that structure, you lose the habitat, you lose the base of the food chain, and you just don't have, you lose most of the species that are dependent upon that.
Bad news. Jane Lubchenco is administrator of NOAA. She's our guest here at Climate One today, along with Nancy Sutley, who's chair of the Council on Environmental Quality at the White House. I'm Greg Dalton. You mentioned climate change. Let's talk about that. NOAA recently announced that this was the fourth hottest summer on record in the United States. El Nino is increasing. So paint a picture for us what we can expect on the oceans in this era of climate change.
The increasing amount of greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and others in the atmosphere are causing the planet to warm, but it's not just warming. There are a lot of changes that are happening in addition to that. And I mentioned the problems that warming is causing for corals. That excess carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is doing a lot more than just causing the planet to warm. One of those other things it's doing is making oceans more acidic. And as there's more and more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, the oceans have been soaking up some of that carbon dioxide. And as oceans take up CO2, carbon dioxide, from the atmosphere, there's a chemical change that happens that makes oceans more acidic. The carbon dioxide is converted into carbonic acid, and oceans are more acidic. That means that anything that has a calcium carbonate shell or skeleton, from corals to a lot of microscopic plants to sea urchins to lots of other creatures in the ocean that have shells, it's harder for them to make shells, and those shells dissolve more rapidly. And so oceans have become 30% more acidic in the last 100 years because of the carbon dioxide they've been absorbing from the atmosphere. So this is yet another reason to reduce carbon dioxide emissions. And it's one of the ways in which oceans are bearing the brunt of many of our activities in a way that was obviously not intended, but is very problematic nonetheless.
I mean, in a way, it's good that the ocean, well, it's good for the greenhouse gas effect that the ocean is absorbing that carbon, but it's, if I understand you correctly, it's really hurting the oceans. Let's talk about extreme weather events. In, you know, obviously, we hear about NOAA and hurricanes and extreme weather. Will the frequency increase? Will the intensity increase? What can we expect along that front? And then I want to get Nancy in on how the policy might have, you know, this new policy might plan for more extreme weather events.
All of the good, solid scientific predictions that we have about what's likely down the road with climate change, not so much predictions but forecasts, really point to much greater variability and more extreme events. And so the amazing stretch of heat wave that Russia has experienced, Moscow in particular, this summer, that is once in a millennium event now, will likely become much more routine in the future if we continue, if we don't curb carbon dioxide emissions. The really, really intense flooding that Pakistan has seen, with about a fifth of the country having just really intense rainfall events, those kinds of things are likely to be more frequent in the future. So more extreme events more often. And even though we cannot point to any one of those and say, aha, that's a smoking gun that proves that climate is changing, those are consistent with what we expect to see under a climate-changed world. More and more extreme events, and not just in those countries, but in our own as well. And we have already seen very significant increases in intense precipitation events, more heat waves, more extremes. And we fully expect that in addition to things like sea level rise that are potentially problematic for most of the coastline of the U.S., there are also these other extreme events.
Nancy Sutley, you work in the White House. What's the White House doing to get prepared for all of this?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. One of the things that we started pretty early in the administration, and Jane has joined me on, and the Office of Science and Technology Policy, is to pull together the federal agencies to try to develop a strategy about how we're going to deal with the impacts of climate change. So looking at adapting to the impacts of climate change. And of course, our priority is to minimize those impacts by trying to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, mitigate climate change. But we know we're going to have to deal with the inevitable effects of climate change. So we've been working for about a year, and we have a report to the president in October looking at what does the federal government need to do to organize itself to respond to the impacts of climate change. And so if you think about programs that the federal government runs, so for example, if the Federal Highway Administration is going to fund a new highway in the Florida Keys, well, they should be thinking about
building it a lot higher.
What the risks and the vulnerability to rising sea levels are of that, you know, of that federal investment, as well as thinking as agencies who, for example, have land management responsibilities or responsibilities over species, thinking about how, for example, forest management plans or wildlife refuges are going to have to recognize changes in the species that they're going to find in that wildlife refuge. And so we've been working on this for a while and expect to have this strategy out. But I think one of the really important things is we've done a lot of public meetings on this. We've talked to a lot of people. One of the real places where the federal government is going to have to step up is to help state and local government deal with these impacts.
Yeah.
And I came to back to the federal government from local government, and you know, we said that local government are the first responders. So if it's sea level rise, how is that going to affect San Francisco Bay or the sewage treatment plants that the city of San Francisco operates, wildfire in California, changes in hydrology and the impact on water resources in California. These are all things that government is going to have to deal with, and we're already starting to see those effects. So we're all working really hard to get this strategy out. It's part of our overall federal sustainability efforts. The president issued an executive order last October requiring the federal government to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 28%. But part of it, also in that executive order, is this: we've got to deal with how we're going to adapt to climate change and how we're going to help the nation adapt to the inevitable effects of climate change.
Dr. Lubchenco.
Greg, one thing that, just to build on what Nancy has said, one thing that we're doing at NOAA is an internal reorganization to create a new service. We have the Fisheries Service, we have the Weather Service, we have the Ocean Service. This will be the NOAA Climate Service. And it is designed specifically to be able to provide information that is understandable and credible about climate change, with the idea of having it be able to better inform a lot of decisions, whether it's by businesses or by city governments or other federal agencies. And the reality is there's a lot of information that's out there, but it's hard sometimes to find it. And we've created a new portal, climate.gov, that is designed to help provide information, and we will be populating that with more and more.
Sorry, I need to interrupt. No flash, please. That doesn't work for television. Okay, thanks. Pardon me for that technical interruption. The use of fossil fuels is what's driving the climate situation. So before we go to the audience questions, I want to ask about, circle back to the Gulf and the oil situation. You mentioned, Nancy Sutley, the Western governors. Western senators have proposed a ban on offshore oil drilling along the West Coast. Senator Boxer was here on this stage last week talking about that. Is that something that you support, that the administration supports?
Well, the administration supported new drilling on the West Coast, and the announcement
a little bit in Alaska, but very little in Alaska.
I think that we know we're dependent on fossil fuels, and we need them to power our economy, but we also have this tremendous opportunity to move from being almost entirely dependent on fossil fuels to more efficient use of energy and use of renewable energy, and to really take a leadership role around the world in this new clean energy economy. And part of it is, we each as individuals have decisions we make every day about how much fossil fuels we use, and so we can all make decisions to use more or less. But we also, as a nation, need to make investments, and we need, as the government, to create policies that will provide the incentives to grow this clean energy economy. And I think that's ultimately the answer for dealing with whether it's the environmental impacts of oil drilling or the environmental impacts of any way that we create energy.
And until that happens, though, we need oil. And do you have a preference of whether we get it on land or offshore? Where should we drill?
Fortunately, that's
somebody else's job
to figure out. But I think
someone else's backyard. That's what.
In response to the oil spill, I think the Department of the Interior is taking a serious look at what reforms are necessary to ensure the American people that, to the extent that we continue to produce oil from our offshore resources, that it's done in a safe and environmentally responsible manner. I think they realize that they have a lot of there's a lot of room for improvement in how they do that. And the Council on Environmental Quality, we have responsibilities over the National Environmental Policy Act and how agencies carry out their environmental reviews. We've been working with the Department of the Interior to help improve their environmental review practices. There's a real commitment on the part of Secretary Salazar and Michael Bromwich, the head of BOEM, the new head of BOEM, to reform the agency and to reform how they do business. So I think the priority for the administration is to be able to ensure that to the American people that that as we are reliant on fossil fuels and as we develop these resources, that we're doing it in a safe and responsible, environmentally responsible manner.
Nancy Sutley is chair of the Council on Environmental Quality at the White House. She's our guest here at Climate One, along with Dr. Jane Lubchenco, who is administrator of NOAA. I'm Greg Dalton. Last question before we go to audience questions. Dr. Lubchenco, NOAA put out a report recently that said that of the nearly 5 million barrels of oil spilled in the Gulf, 75% has been cleaned up by man or Mother Nature. Now, a group of researchers at Georgia, I believe it's the Georgia Sea Grant Group, estimate that 90% remains and 10% of the oil removed has been burned or skimmed. So how do we know how much oil is still in the ocean?
So let's start with a couple of things. One, we have a pretty good estimate now of how much oil was released during the entire disaster, and that's 4.9 million barrels, plus or minus 10%. So that gives us a good starting number. What the interagency report actually said was that it's been mischaracterized and misrepresented. So let me set the record straight. What it said was that a quarter of the oil was burned, skimmed, or captured. Mm-hmm. So that's gone from the system. A quarter of the oil has been evaporated. So that's gone from the system. So half of that, 4.9 million barrels, is gone. Not 75%, but half. Another quarter has been dispersed, and that's both chemically and naturally dispersed. And it's important to recognize that twice as much was dispersed naturally as with chemicals. And that quarter, which is about 1.2 million barrels, is a very significant amount of oil. And that was released into the it's below the surface of the water. It never made it to the surface. Those are the three pieces of the pie that you can actually either measure directly or estimate with some degree of confidence. The remaining quarter is what's left if you add up all those and subtract that from 4.9. So that remaining quarter is a combination of light sheen that's at the surface, oil that washed up onto beaches, some of which has been recovered, or tar balls. And it's really hard to estimate or measure any of those. So that's what the pie chart actually said. The Georgia Sea Grant folks started with a very different number. They took away the amount that was captured, and so they're starting with a different number, and so of course all the percentages are different. And the calculation that they did for the amount of oil that was evaporated was very, very low. They said about 17%. We thought our 25% was actually very, very conservative. And some estimates are as high as 40%. That's one of the areas where it's hard to know what the exact number is. And so we chose what we thought was a very conservative number. So that's the only real difference between our calculations and theirs. But if you take different sizes of, you know, if you mm-hmm. run the numbers differently, you
from
get
different
answers.
Starting points. Yeah.
That's right. So, but I think what we, you know, everybody is really intensely curious about where that oil is. And this was a tool that was developed by an interagency scientist to help guide the federal response about where to deploy assets, essentially. And it was a very useful tool, but we thought it was important to be transparent and tell people what we knew, which is why we released this, the oil budget pie chart, if you will. And I think the most important thing to say about it is that the oil that was dispersed, that is beneath the surface, is a very serious concern to us because the oil is toxic even when it's in very, very small microscopic droplets. And those microscopic droplets are not benign. They are very highly dilute, except just right around the wellhead. If you go just a short distance from that and you scoop up water even early on that had this dispersed oil in it and bring it to the surface, it looks clear. It was in parts per million. So it's very, very dilute, which is not at all the impression that a lot of people have, that there is this black lake that's beneath the surface that's just moving around under there. It's highly, highly dilute. So that's important for people to know. But dilute does not mean benign. And we have very grave concerns about the potential that that oil had to adversely impact especially young, vulnerable stages, fish eggs, fish larvae, shrimp, crab larvae, any of those. And it's very difficult to measure what impact that has. It's going to be years before we really know. And we mentioned bluefin tuna early on. That's one species of many that had eggs and young larval stages in the water column during this event. And so we have very serious concerns about the long-term impact that this oil is going to have on the things beneath the surface. It's bad enough to, you know, see the oiled pelicans and the oiled turtles at the surface, and we know that quite a few of those were very seriously impacted. There is some good news in all of that. We launched a very aggressive effort to go out and recover turtles, and did, in fact, recover a lot of very heavily to moderately oiled turtles, most of whom are juvenile 1 to 2 year old Kemp's Ridley turtles. And these are an endangered species. And of the ones that were recovered alive, they were brought back into rehab and have been cleaned up, and most of them are doing very, very well. And in fact, I had the great treat of releasing the first batch of them back into the Gulf once the oil was pretty much gone.
That's a real success story, I think. 1,400 or so of them? That's one number I heard. But a lot of them, that's a real success story of the Gulf.
It is.
Let's get to audience questions. We have about 12 minutes left. We'll have brief questions, brief answers, and try to include as many as we can. Welcome.
Hi, Jane and Nancy. Thank you so much for being here tonight. I'm Holly Kaufman. Following up on the climate change discussion, my understanding was that, Nancy, your agency, the President's Council on Environmental Quality, had a group of representatives from different agencies trying to work on pushing the climate legislation forward, and that group has now disbanded. And that's my understanding. Perhaps you can correct me. But at any rate, the question is, what is, at this point, the administration's plan, or is there one, for what we're going to do at the federal level on climate change? We know we can't predict what's going to go on in Congress, but other than knowing that this issue matters to the president and it's still a priority, can you give some specifics about where the federal government is and what the plan is to make something happen in the near future?
Sure. Well, climate change, you know, dealing with climate change remains a priority for the administration, for the president. He strongly believes that our economic future depends on our ability to transition to a clean energy economy. We've made significant investment in that, the largest federal investment in clean energy through the Recovery Act, almost $90 billion, not only for things that are off the shelf, but for development, commercialization, and research and development into new energy technologies. So, and these are creating jobs across the country and responding to our economic crisis. And, you know, but in the end, you know, Congress has got to act, and they have to act on comprehensive energy and climate legislation. And that's our goal. The president's been very vocal about that. The last thing I'd say is, you know, in the meantime, we are taking actions. We are doing things at the federal government level to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And we work closely with the state of California on setting new fuel economy standards for the first time. EPA and the Department of Transportation have worked together on automobile standards. They're currently working on truck standards and on the next round of automobile standards. At CEQ, we've been leading an effort, as I said before, on sustainability in the federal government. The federal government is the single largest energy consumer in the U.S. economy. 600,000 buildings, 500,000 vehicles, so we're a significant, small but significant source of greenhouse gas emissions. And so, you know, looking across the agencies at the various things that they can do, not just EPA, but other agencies looking at ways that they can help to promote this clean energy economy.
Navy Secretary Ray Mabus was here recently, and I think of all of the government, the Navy and the military may be doing more than a lot of others. Yes, sir.
Bob Thronson, I'm a clean tech entrepreneur. There's a lot of energy in the oceans other than oil. So I'm wondering what your organizations are doing to streamline the current regulatory approval process, which is extremely painful now, for offshore wind and wave power.
Well, we discovered as we came to into the administration that we had a couple of agencies claiming jurisdiction over offshore wind development, that being the Department of the Interior and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They came to an agreement about how to divide that up, so hopefully that at least takes care of one log jam. The Department of the Interior, Secretary Salazar, is very committed to seeing what the department can do to ensure that people who want to develop these offshore renewable energy sources know what they need to do and streamline the permitting process and give them a straightforward path. So that process is underway. I think also as part of this National Ocean Policy, one of the things that we recognized was, you know, there are going to be places in the ocean where it's, you know, ideal for wind power or wave power, and figuring out sort of what where it fits in the other uses of the ocean and try to reduce those conflicts is something that we think we'll be able to do through the National Ocean Council.
Nancy Sutley is chair of the Council on Environmental Quality at the White House. Next question, please.
The effort at Copenhagen was an attempt to keep global warming to 2 degrees centigrade or less, and that hasn't happened. And we don't have national legislation at that level either. And MIT came out with a report last year predicting warming of 5 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. What kind of warming projections are you guys working with, and what effects would levels of warming like that have on the oceans?
Well, I think the focus of the administration has been very much on reducing emissions, both in terms of the federal government's footprint, but also trying to work with Congress, as Nancy has described. So there's no one magic number that we're working with in terms of projections. But I think it's safe to say that oceans are already exhibiting many signs that they are already affected, and that there is, as with what happens on land, the faster we can reduce emissions, the less deleterious most of the impacts are going to be. So I think there is great urgency in reducing emissions as fast as possible.
Next question, please.
Stephen Knight with Save the Bay. As you're working on finalizing this ocean policy, I wanted to point you to some examples of general guidance that we've gotten here in California, some of the leadership that Dr. Lubchenco mentioned that have been very useful to us and practically. The California Ocean Protection Council announced a year or two ago, the trash implementation strategy. And there are some just high-level bullet points in there, like...
we need to keep this pretty...
Yes, brief, so. Which just essentially we have been able to take and run with on the ground, getting water board permits enacted, helping getting trash out of the bay and the ocean. And the governor's climate adaptation strategy, which here in California we're using to battle inappropriate shoreline development. So I just know that you will look to California's leadership on these issues to help provide the whole country with some concrete examples of policies that can actually be enacted on the ground.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question, please.
Hi, Olaf Hansen. My question is actually about the land-water interface. I don't want to quote you, Nancy, on that nice word that you didn't want to mention again. I had a chance on a transatlantic climate bridge program to see actually the port of Hamburg, which is larger than Long Beach or San Pedro or New Orleans, and all of their strategies on adaptation, mitigation, sort of climate zero, construction right on in the harbor, no dirty diesel while the vessels are in port. I'm curious, what is the national ocean policy doing about saving these big investments, our ports, probably going to be trillions of dollars of investment? Can you talk a little bit about
the ports,
how that affects?
How do the ports fit in?
Well, I think one of the priority areas, looking at what policy areas we need to deal with immediately, one of them is that land-water interface, where the land meets the oceans. And I think also with respect to adaptation, thinking about what the impacts of sea level rise will be on a whole series of infrastructure, whether it's ports, airports, sewage treatment plants, houses, floodplains. We have to think about all these things and look at policies, the federal policies, and where there need to be changes in the federal policies. And I think it's going to, the agencies ultimately are going to have to look at their own programs and ensure that they're considering the risk and vulnerability to climate change of whatever it is they're working with, and try to increase the resilience of those things. So whether it's ports or sewage treatment plants, to the impacts of climate change. And there's an important climate assessment process that's going on right now at the national level. It's just kicked off a few months back. That'll help to better define what those impacts are. And one of the, I think, the important pieces of our adaptation work has been to highlight and to recognize that we have to be able to translate that science into policy. So understanding what those impacts are and how does it translate into policy, whether it's at the federal level, the state level, or the local government level.
And how are we going to pay for it? That's the one that always troubles me. We have regional officials here who say, we know climate change is coming. It's going to cost us more to keep what we already have in terms of infrastructure, water systems, waste systems, et cetera. We're laying off teachers. We're laying off police officers. Call us when you have some money to deal with the problem. That's what the state people say. So are the feds going to come in with not just policy, but actually dollars to do this sorts of thing? Because states are broke, cities are broke, and the country's broke too. But that's
well. But I think the answer. I don't know. I mean, the Congress makes the appropriations,
And they have a pay-as-you-go process.
And they have a pay-as-you-go process. But the federal government spends a lot of money on stuff. We fund a lot of things. We fund highways. We fund sewage treatment plants. We create the circumstances to fund airports, to fund rail.
Money's there if we want to do it.
So I'll give an example. Some of my friends from EPA are here. So they run this state revolving fund program. That's how low-cost loans for local government to build sewage treatment plants. It makes sense for EPA to think about what guidance should they give to those local governments as they're asking for these loans to think about the impacts of climate change. So San Francisco has an ocean discharge. Is it going to affect... Does sea level rise affect that ocean discharge? So as EPA loans money out to local governments for sewage infrastructure, they can give guidance to those local governments about how to think about the impacts of climate change. So they're not throwing away money. So in a way,
or the same is true of HUD, for example.
That's right. And so, in terms of building public housing, are there ways to make that public housing more resilient to the mm-hmm. impacts of climate mm-hmm. change, whether it's extreme weather events or more hot weather, things like that? So I think there are a lot of places where the federal government already funds programs that, considering how climate change may impact those programs, sure. is an important so that we make the best use of those dollars, and in the end, we can be more resilient and less vulnerable to the impacts of climate change.
And that's been one of the real benefits of this Climate Adaptation Task Force, that there's been a transfer of information from science agencies like mine that have information about sea level rise or climate change to HUD or Department of Transportation, so that there can be better awareness and understanding of how can we spend the dollars that exist in the most climate smart ways.
What we've heard from a lot of local governments and state government also is what they also need is information. How do we bring this information into our own decision making? And that's a really important thing that the federal government is almost uniquely positioned to do because of the extensive scientific database and capabilities within the federal government.
So we're tackling some of those big challenges.
Unfortunately, we had time for one last question. So quick question, quick answers. Apologies to those who we didn't get to, but you have some planes to catch here. So.
Okay, thank you. My name's Roger Thomas. I represent a whole bunch of salmon fishermen. And salmon have survived in the oceans forever. And we all know what the problems are with the ocean. I like your words when you talk about enhancement and sustainability and all those things. Has the council considered how they're going to look at the real problems with salmon and work with the federal agencies or mandate them somehow to keep the salmon going the way they should be? And that's basically my question, and I realize it's a great big bureaucracy that's going on and you have troubles, but the basic problem, it's water and all the other things that I could go on about. So somehow you need to start some coordination.
Thank you very much.
And for Dr. Luchenko, I'd like to compliment her on the activities of National Marine Fisheries and the buy-up that they did last year. The fishing community supports that 100%. Thank you.
Let me just say briefly in response that salmon really illustrate many of these land-sea connections and the fact that our former policies haven't really understood how what happens on the land affects the ocean part and vice versa. And one of the opportunities for this National Ocean Council, the regional planning bodies, is to begin working with states and incorporate more of these land-sea connections. And salmon are a perfect reason to be doing that and doing it in a much better way than we have in the past.
I was going to give that same answer.
Thank you.
I'm pleased that I was going to give the same answer.
So we're done. Okay. Our thanks to Nancy Sutley, Chair of the Environmental Council on Environmental Quality at the White House, and Dr. Jane Lubchenco, Administrator of NOAA, for their comments here at Climate One today. I'm Greg Dalton. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you very much.